This is America's Fabric, a program about the cultural beliefs and foundations of our exceptional country. The program you're about to hear will help connect those beliefs and foundations to today's society. The program is paid for by the America's Fabric organization, funded by individual sponsorship. Here is your host for today's program.
Good morning and welcome to America's Fabric. I'm Charles Heller and I'll be your host today. I don't get a chance to do as many of these manually as I'd like to, culling content, other excellent content as a matter of fact, from other sources, mostly from Yanya Kellick's interviews on American thought leaders. But recently on this radio station, the issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion has come up in both editorials and also in op-eds, opposing editorials, and I want to throw my two cents worth in here on it, and the sources that I'm using and the sources that I've used in diversity, equity, inclusion include federal law, the Heritage Foundation, Harvard Law, and a few others tossed in. The topic of equity, diversity, and inclusion has come up, and in the name of the public airing of topics in keeping with our broadcast license, I'm going to present some perspectives on the topic. In order to do that, we first have to really define the terms. Webster's Dictionary defines diversity as, quote, an instance of being composed of differing elements or qualities, an instance of being diverse, unquote. In the modern sense, diversity is measured by outcome, or the number of people of diverse background in any environment, mostly in the workplace. One of the issues with the modern use of the term diversity is measuring it by pure statistical outcome. In other words, how many of each ethnicity or each sexual proclivity or whatever work in a particular environment as contrasted with the population of a community or of a state. There are many problems with determining work environments by diversity as opposed to objective standards of job competency, otherwise known as merit. It has been against federal law to discriminate against people in any public accommodation or hiring for many years, as well it should be. And don't believe what I say here. Look it up yourself. It's the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and it's mostly in Title 42 of U.S. Code. Equal opportunity is a bedrock principle in the U.S. since the Civil War, and especially since the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 1960s. The U.S. has waged a long struggle for equality of opportunity, but not for equality of result. Equality of result is referred to in courts as disparate effect, and it's been emphasized less and less, and we're moving away from it as well we should in this country. In the 50s and 60s, the U.S. waged a long struggle for equality of opportunity, judging equality by mere statistical numbers of ethnic minorities or country of origin is a prescription for societal resentment and discord. In fact, some have described it as Tower of Babel. Let's have an example. You're putting your daughter on an airplane to go off to college. Do you want the pilot to be selected by their ethnicity or their skill at flying a plane? They need not be at odds, but they must not be exclusive of each other. For instance, if an airline makes it a point to recruit from a college that is primarily from one ethnic demographic, that's not a bad thing. For instance, Howard University in the District of Columbia is known primarily as a black school. Established in 1867, Howard University is a federally chartered, private, doctoral research, extensive university located in Washington, D.C., with an enrollment of approximately 11,000 students in its undergraduate, graduate, and professional and joint degree programs, which span more than 120 areas of study with 13 schools and colleges. The university is dedicated to educating students from diverse backgrounds. Since its founding in 1867, Howard has awarded more than 120,000 degrees and certificates in the arts, the sciences, and the humanities. As part of the struggle to encourage opportunity for people of so-called underprivileged background, Howard has strived to provide those opportunities. If an airline wanted to send someone to Howard to recruit pilots and other job descriptions there, That's a good thing, as long as the same standards of aviation excellence are applied at Howard University that they would be to recruiting at any other place. That's what we did in World War II when we trained black students to be fighter pilots at Tuskegee College. Their record in combat was exemplary and went a long way towards destroying racial stereotypes and breaking the color barrier. Black pilots at the end of that war were still denied the opportunity to be airline pilots, and it took another 2 decades to get rid of that discrimination. Diversity, though, is getting rid of the discrimination, not setting racial or other quotas for hiring. The way you end discrimination is to stop discriminating. You don't set new standards of discrimination to make up for the old discrimination. Or if you do that, you do it for a very short period of time, a set and well-defined period. If you can define the idea of what was done in the past, you set a quota and a goal, and then after that you stop doing it so that you have true equality, not equity. Today, we tend to elevate diversity as an end in and of itself, as if there was some intrinsic value of having quotas of people of a certain color or ethnic background or sexual preference over the idea of job competence. Over the last 50 years, the concept of what's called disparate impact has risen through the courts as a metric of discrimination. Let's talk for a moment about privilege. What we have here is not some form of an ethnic privilege. What we have in the United States is called American privilege. Diversity, as it's used, can descend into racism in the name of inclusion, if it's measured by quota or disparate impact of the racial distribution of results. If a practice has a greater impact on one or another ethnic group, it's sometimes seen as prima facie evidence of discrimination. This flies in the face of the ideas of Dr. Martin Luther King, who had a dream that one day his children would be judged by the content of their character rather than by the color of their skin. Our civil rights laws are written to do just that, but they've been warped and misapplied to try and enforce quotas through our legal system. There's been noted pushback against those quotas and practices since the 1978 Bakke case for so-called reverse discrimination. You can look that up in Regents of the University of California versus Bakke at 438 U.S. 265, again from 1978. When the so-called topic of diversity begins to drift into disparate impact and quotas, it falls into the realm of discrimination on the basis of race, the very metric of racism itself. The definition of racism is looking at people through a lens of race, of judging them by what they look like or where they came from, rather than who they are and how they behave. How about we look at only performance? This is not some ethereal ideal, but a measurable statistic. On the topic of performance, when you look at the national test scores, it is clear that certain schools lag behind the performance of others, and that tends to hit minorities harder than non-minority children. This leads some groups to the cry of racism. The dirty secret is that it's not really due to race, power, or privilege. It is due to socioeconomic status. People who live in poorer communities tend to have poorer opportunities. Race does not hold anyone back in this country. Just ask Barack Obama, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, or Oprah Winfrey. The United States has more black billionaires than any country on earth. And according to Statista.com, there are 1.9 million black millionaires in the United States. Now, there is a lower percentage of black millionaires than there are black people in the United States, just as there are a lower percentage of Hispanic millionaires than there are percentages of Hispanic people in the United States. But that's not racism. It has more to do with socioeconomic status than anything else. Wealth in the U.S. is not determined by race or inheritance. The main determinants of wealth in the U.S. are behavioral. Now, some people will say that that's a racist statement, but it isn't. It's an objectively true statement. The biggest determinants of behavior are family structure and mentorship. Marriage happens to be one of the largest determinants of poverty in the United States. People who get a high school diploma, do not have children out of wedlock, and get a job are only 8% nationally of the people below the poverty line. Marriage is the best anti-poverty program there is. Many arguments are made about so-called privilege, but said privilege is available to anyone who applies the principles of success in their life. The shame of it is that we do not always teach those principles to our children. More than half the children in the U.S. cannot pass tests at grade level in math and reading. This isn't race-based. A white kid who can't read has no advantage over a black kid or a Hispanic kid who can't read. None. A strong family who teaches their children how to read before they get to school has a far greater chance of success than a single parent who unwisely trusts the public school system to teach their kids to read. If your child can't read, it's not because of some supremacist somewhere. It's because you failed to teach your child to read. Now, maybe that's because you can't read that well. Or maybe you lack the skill or the patience or the time to be able to do that because you're too busy working as a single parent. But the fact remains that if your child can't read, it's not because of racism. It's because of socioeconomic issues. And it's also because of the failing performance, mostly of the public schools. Teaching children to read should be made into a fun learning experience with games and rewards. Let me give you a big hint. You love to read. It's highly likely that your kids will love to read. Your child will have a better chance of growing up to be a rocket scientist if you go build an Estes model rocket with them than if you plop yourself in front of the TV, or worse, you give them their own screen of some type and let them disappear into it. Do you know that model rocketry works just the same for people no matter what color they are or what country they came from? If you build a model rocket and you light the fuse, it goes up just the same no matter what your ethnicity. If you can't afford to buy a kit to build a rocket, order yourself the little tubes that the rocket engine comes in and make the tube they come in into the rocket itself. Carve the nose cones and the fins out of balsa wood with sandpaper and an X-Acto knife, or a razor blade if you can't afford an X-Acto knife. In addition to leading by example, you will instill in your children a thirst for knowledge that will serve them well as they pass that skill set on to their grandchildren. I'm not saying there is no racism. I will advise you, do your best to make the nose cone nice and even. Otherwise, the rockets have a tendency to fly off in one direction or another. And make the fins the same size, too. But I digress. I'm not saying that there is no racism in the United States. There certainly is. Humans are tribal creatures, and we are preset by nature to prefer whatever tribe that we're a member of. You know, birds of a feather flock together. That's a human condition. It's not a particularly American condition. Prejudice must always be overcome. Who you become, though, is greatly influenced by who you hang out with. If you can't afford a rocket, find a rocket club and ask for help. People will be thrilled to help you, and you'll learn from physics, reading, geometry, computational math, all for the price of asking. Remember that mostly white, Asian, and Hispanic people in the United States elected a black man president twice. There is no prejudice which cannot be overcome. So-called diversity, as it's applied today, militates in the direction of racism itself. So how do we apply merit as a metric of qualification? You do it by objective standards rather than subjective, in other words, racial standards. Just like a stopwatch in a track meet, we apply objective standards of measurement of performance and grade on that standard. If you have a stopwatch, there are no black, white, nor Hispanic seconds. There's only the time on the stopwatch. It's your attitude and your ethic that determines your success, not your ethnicity. Did you ever see the movie Night at the Museum? In one scene, the Tuskegee Airmen are moving across the exhibit floor, and they run into Amelia Earhart going the other way. They stop and they salute her, and she's stunned. And they say to her, "They told us we couldn't do it either." The lesson in that scene is worth the full retail price of admission to the theater when it comes to overcoming prejudice. Now let's look at equity as it's applied to DEI. Its use here is a deliberate subterfuge. Equity is meant to be conflated with equality of result. Equity is not the same as equality. In fact, some might argue that they are the opposite of each other. Here's why. American society today is rooted in the idea of equal opportunity. We each have the opportunity to express our creative ideas and skills in such a way as to prosper from them. From each according to his skills to each according to his bank deposit slip. That's the way our society is designed to work. That's what the free market is, the ability to compete. Equity, on the other hand, implies equality of result, independent of the quality and the quantity of the work. The idea of equity is manifestly unfair, as it does not reward the participant according to his effort, but according to some imposed standard imposed by central planning. Let me remind you that there is no such thing as a central plan for freedom. There's no commissar that's going to impose success on you. This is yo-yo and yo-yor, which stands yo-yo is you're on your own, and yo-yor is you own your own results. You might want to write that down, yo-yo and yo-yor. You're on your own, and you own your own results. Some have asserted that we have been pledging allegiance to that principle since childhood of equity, but it's not true. We pledge allegiance to the flag which stands for liberty and justice for all, not diversity and inclusion for all. Saying that equity is an American principle is like saying that Parmesan cheese is a food group. It's a false narrative only meant to disguise something antithetical to our ethos as Americans. Now to inclusion. Inclusion is a method to normalize what we are not comfortable with. If you wish to have tantric sex with pachyderms and worship plastic fruit, nobody but the Pachyderm Coalition is going to give you much of a hard time. This is America. Do what you want. Just please not in public where it scares the horses. If you're an adult, you can have whatever you want cut off, added on, rearranged, or replumbed. Doing these things, though, imposes no duty on anyone else to treat you in some particular way, call you by a particular word, or impose any condition upon any other human being. Just because you have pronouns does not force other people to adopt them. That's not inclusion. That's forcing other people to accept what you want, rather than realizing they're free people, too. Some have said that the rejection of diversity, equity, and inclusion have come upon us in a fit of a passionate fashion statement. To explore that, let us look to the roots of the concept which underlay DEI. The philosophy of it travels by way of what's called critical theory, which is metastasized into law, education, race relations, and certain sexual proclivities. All forms of it have their roots in class struggle that came to us long ago from Marx and traveled to us through the Frankfurt School at Columbia in the 1930s. Proponents of it included Max Horkheimer and later Herbert Marcuse. Critical theory is a play on semantics. The theory was simple. Criticize every pillar of Western culture. Family, democracy, common law, freedom of speech, and others. The hope was that these pillars would crumble under the pressure. Their work split society into two main groups, the oppressors and the victims. They argued that history and reality were shaped by those groups who controlled traditional institutions. The intent of this struggle, in quotes, was to break down American mores. The social movements of the 1960s, black power, feminism, gay rights, sexual liberation gave Marcuse a unique vehicle to release cultural Marxist ideas into the mainstream. Railing against all things establishment, Frankfurt School's ideals caught on like wildfire across American universities. Marcuse then published Repressive Tolerance in 1965, as the various social movements in America were in full swing. In it, he argued that tolerance of all values and all ideals meant the repression of correct ideas, with correct in quotes. It was here that Marcuse coined the term liberating tolerance. It called for tolerance of any ideas coming from the left, but intolerance of those coming from anywhere else. One of the overarching themes of the Frankfurt School was a total intolerance for any viewpoint but its own. Sound familiar? It's also the basic trait of today's political correctness believers. By the way, do you know who coined the term political correctness? Vladimir Lenin. It meant that anyone who didn't agree with the government philosophy was therefore not politically correct and not deserving of any benefits. Does that intolerance sound anything at all like the attempted squelching of all viewpoints on social media opposed to the government narrative on COVID origins, vaccines, and lockdowns now coming to light in the wake of the Biden administration's fall from power? Does it resonate with the discovery of the infirmity of the previous president of the United States to execute the duties of his office and the cover-up of that incapacity? Some people have asserted that a credible meritocracy will only exist when humans no longer lust for power. That's a false narrative. The founders wrote our Constitution to deal exactly with the human lust for power in our system of checks and balances under the rule of law. That rule of law specifically nails the jackboot of government lust for power to the planks of the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights, if we would only read and apply it. So-called diversity, equity, and inclusion are a corrosive solvent meant to dissolve the bands of human connection and social intercourse mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. They're sharp tools designed to be used to separate us from the principles that hold us to one another and the tenets of liberty. Ronald Reagan said that freedom was never more than one generation away from extinction. Diversity, equity, and inclusion is one of the methodologies of that extinction. One of the true battlegrounds of the fight to maintain liberty is our schools. That is one of the myriad reasons that some portion of the anti-liberty forces cling so hard to the idea of public education and the blockage of school choice. Separating children from parents for the purposes of indoctrination is one method of preserving that pedagogy. Grooming children into the idea that it's possible to change their sex is an outgrowth of critical theory and its illegitimate stepchild, diversity, equity, and inclusion. If you think that mutilating children in the name of political power is a good idea, DEI will not be much of a stretch for you. If you think that this is an exaggeration, I encourage you to read the works of Marcuse, Horkheimer, and while we're at it, throw in Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky, which, by the way, was dedicated to the person who was so good at activism that he got his own domain, Satan. None of this evidence is hidden. It's open and notorious to those who are a Huey O, that is, heads up, eyes open. I'd also like to thank the newest sponsor, the Pima County Republican Club, which meets on Tuesdays at 12 noon at the Kettle Restaurant just west of I-10 on 22nd Street. Thank you for stepping up. We could use a couple more. Stay tuned for an announcement on how you can do that. In Liberty, I'm Charles Heller. Thank you for listening to America's Fabric. This program is paid for by approximately half commercial sponsors. The great ones, Perfection Auto Works has been our longest. More recently, Wilkinson Wealth Management. And of course, Tucson Going and Autograph. The other half is paid for by you. And please prayerfully consider, if you'd like to support this program being a sponsor, you can do so by sending a check to America's Fabric, care of KVOI Radio, 3222 South Ritchie, Tucson, Arizona, 85713. Again, America's Fabric, care of KVOI, 3222 South Ritchie, Tucson, Arizona, 85713.